Called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with me today, it's a joy to have with us the original Hellboy, although I still like him as Clayface, Ron Perlman, actor and activist, and of course, a bon vivant tweeter during the Trump administration. Ron, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
With great vivant.
With great, and we'll have some more of that vivant when we come back right after this.
Maybe not.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with us today is actor Ron Perlman. And Ron, the title of the podcast is Just Ask the Question. So in memory of my mentor, Helen Thomas. So I'll just ask you the question.
Oh, wow.
That was one of the very first things she ever told me when I met her. She said, whatever you do, it doesn't matter what their answer is. It doesn't matter if they answer the question, just ask the question. That way they can't deny that it's on the public record. And then of course, Sam Donaldson told me, and I'll teach you how to yell loud enough so they hear you. And after that, I had fun. So
good mentoring there.
Yeah, great. And Sam's still a good friend. I love him to death. I'll start with just asking you the question. You were one of the first people I noticed outside of politics or outside of those of us covering this administration when the current Trump administration started, that went after Donald Trump, and you have continued to do so for the last 4 years. What prompted you to do it?
It's hard to remember I don't think I'm equipped to identify the exact moment, but I was on my guard because I grew up in New York City and Donald Trump, he and I are like only 4 years apart. So we've both been traveling in similar zeitgeists for north of 70 years. And you really got to understand that this guy was a walking joke. I mean, and he was an embarrassment at everything he put his hand to. He was as dissonant in the way he tried to insert himself into your life in order to imbue himself with importance and relevance, that it was always as fucked up and embarrassing. And like, wait a minute, when you're a snake oil salesman, you gotta have a good patter, man. I mean, there's gotta be some cleverness there. There's gotta be some duality, some wit, some real kind of like, you have to, figure out a way to lure in why can't I remember the name? The Rubes.
Yeah.
That's your game. And that's all he's ever been as a con man. And every single thing that he's ever applied himself to has been a con of one kind or another, all of which is connected to this insatiable psychological sickness that is completely out of control and so deeply embedded in him that there's no returning from him. He's irredeemable. Whatever his, like you mentioned as we were getting ready to come on the air, his dad, I can't imagine. It has to all come from mom and dad, because there's a reflexive kind of Pavlovian kind of response. We've now seen him in under every light, as president of the United States, we have gotten to see him from everything from maybe we just put some bleach, we just started injecting Clorox into you and boom, I mean.
And exposing your insides to light. That was, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so we've seen him in every light and it's his inability to exhibit any of the qualities that define humanness is so deeply seated that it had to have been like from the cradle onward, you know, he had to have like, you know, either repeatedly been dropped on his head and then kicked across the room to the point where, okay, if I'm going to get any kind of love from my dad, I better hope I get dropped on my fucking head and kicked across the room. And because every single thing that he does to provoke the attention that he craves in a way that is undefinable. I mean, you know, we'll get back to the great minds and thoughts that we've heard over the last 4 years that have been trying to kind of, you know, put words to the music that we're trying not to hear. But
hard to put words to the chaos that I've seen. It's just chaos in a blender.
But he goes to places that even the greatest, like Hemingway's and Faulkner's, would have trouble quantifying, because he does things that we're not prepared for.
Give me an example of one that you weren't prepared for.
I wasn't prepared for. I mean, I was prepared. It's a tricky question, because I was prepared for him to be as outrageous as possible. But when he was just a complete fucking asshole playboy, you know, with a trust fund in New York, and you'd sort of see him on the occasional, you know, radio trying to sell steaks and water and universities, you know, he was dismissible.
Yeah.
But
as president, not so much.
And he began to exhibit the kind of values that he was going to introduce into the rules right into debates. I mean, you know, the way he treated the other 18 guys on the stage with him was no holds barred, and it was really low down schoolyard shit. But not good school. I mean, if he had been in my school, he wouldn't be here right now.
Yeah, he'd have gotten his ass kicked.
He would have tried the shit he pulled on Jeb Bush and Rubio and shit, and he would have just been ended. I mean, he would have been fucking, he would have been taken to some place where nobody could see what was going down, and that'd be it. He would fucking bleed out. Because you don't say shit like that to other human beings without getting your fucking ass handed to you in New York City.
Right.
But somehow he managed to get through, you know, under the graces of.
It's the money that got him there.
Yeah. All of the things that define the Trump empire crime family, you know, without getting his ass kicked. And so that's a miracle, right? But anyway, I guess it was in the debates when you started to realize he's now going to apply the unthinkable to human discourse. He is now going to call people names, deal with people in a way that's not only, you know, you just don't say shit like that to somebody about anybody's wife. You don't call women fat fucks. I mean, you know, you don't do the things that he did, and yet he did it, and he did it, and he did it, and he, you know, John McCain's not a war hero. I like my war heroes not captured. You know, you hear that stuff and alarm bells go off. I mean, with me anyway.
Yeah, that's the question I asked.
And that's all shit before he was elected. So the signposts were vivid and clear.
Why do you think, and the question I ask everyone, look, I've covered it from 4 years being 10 to 15 feet away from him, and sometimes unfortunately and uncomfortably closer as I've asked him questions, and I know why I find him distasteful, and some of the things that you find distasteful about him, I do as well. And for me, the day he made fun of a reporter for a handicap was that you just don't do that. That's just not right. And after that, there was nothing I could see in him that was redeeming. Why do you think, and I ask this of everyone who's not in the briefing room, why do you think there are people who don't see it inside or outside? Why do you think people fall for his con? You grew up in New York City. I grew up the son of a car salesman and lawyers. So I know bullshit when I smell it. So why do you think there are some people can't smell his bullshit, know what it is?
It baffles me because it's inconceivable that anybody would buy one fucking second, one iota of his bullshit. You know, he's so clearly a con man. He's so clearly someone without an ideology or a core or anything other than how do I use up all the oxygen in the room? How do I make myself such a spectacle that you can't take your eyes off of me? That's all it is. That's as deep as it goes. There is no United States of America. There is no presidency of the United States of America. The presidency of the United States of America was the same thing as him being the CEO of the Trump Organization, right? which is everything that I do is to enrich myself and to enhance my brand so that I can enrich myself even further. And no matter how much I do any of those things, I'm still going to be a miserable fucking, you know, I can't say cunt on your.
Yeah, I was going to quote something. What I like about your tweets is you use the language I use when I'm in my house, but I loathe to use it in the briefing room because I don't think they'd answer me or be too kind to me, and they aren't too kind to me to begin with. But, you know, what the fuck is wrong with the president is the only question I really want to ask in that briefing room. And somehow I don't think that one would be answered either. So go ahead. You can use whatever language you want. I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember my train of thought, but he's a miserable cunt.
There's your train of thought. Well, here's my question for you about that. You've said that he's, and look, you're an actor. You go out on stage. You want people to see you in what you do. There are those who say, and this is, I'm going to quote some of the people in the White House who say, oh, I was fans of Hellboy. Why is Hellboy coming after the president? Doesn't he understand? I mean, there are two thoughts. An actor should have no political feelings. And B, he's just doing the same thing you're doing. How do you take issue with those two issues when people say that?
Well, the first one I just dismiss out of hand. I'm a taxpaying citizen, and I am, it just so happens, and you know, I've discovered this more late in life because I was only a political junkie for the last 20 years or so, and it got it kind of augmented itself and evolved the more I was around dissonance. And there was a lot of dissonance in the Bush era. As we can recall, there was a lot of lying, there was a lot of manipulation, there was a lot of needless bloodletting of treasure and human sacrifice, all at the hands of some diabolical set of objectives that weren't going to help anybody in any way except a couple of thousand people.
Yeah.
And something about all that just felt like an assault on me. And so as I became more outraged, I became more engaged. Not that I have actually quantifiably ever done anything about it other than rant and rave and sit in my perch and you know, and I hate myself for that. I hate myself for the fact that I haven't taken to the streets. I hate myself for the fact that I'm not a big fan of guys who sit on the sidelines, you know, like O'Neill called them, the old philosophers, you know, who never really get their hands dirty. I mean, but I do it anyway, because I've spent a lot of time arguing with myself about, like, well, you know,
do you
what
vote?
Can you do? What can you do?
Do you vote?
And if there's anything,
Do you vote?
Oh yeah, I vote.
Well then,
I vote every election.
I mean, you're not doing nothing. You're voting. Now, some would say that's the minimum to do, but at the very least, I can't tell you the number of people I've talked to on both sides of the fence, and they'll either gripe about Trump or sing his praises, and they don't vote. And I can't understand that. That doesn't make sense to me. But the ranting and the raving part, I think, is indicative of how many of us feel. And I don't think that politicians know how we feel unless we make our feelings felt and known. So to that end, the ranting and raving has a purpose if they listen. But my problem with this administration is I don't think they listen to, and they dismiss. And one of the points that I was trying to get to in asking you about being an actor is those inside the administration love to dismiss the opinions of people who don't think the same way they do. And they find numerous reasons to do it. Oh, you're a libtard. Oh, you're an activist. Oh, you're a reporter. Oh, you're an actor. Oh, you're a used car salesman. Whatever it is, they can cleave us from each other. They attempt to do in order to justify and saying, well, no, most people think as we do. It's just this small band of people who do not. So I make your feelings known. I have no problem with that. In fact, I enjoy it. Like I said, I'll quote you. Yo, Mitch, do you ever wonder why you're the most hated motherfucker in America? You make Scrooge and the Grinch look like heroes. People are starving, motherfucker, though no fault of their own, while you live off ill-gotten gains, you fat fuck. I can't think of a better way to describe Mitch McConnell. And I grew up, I grew up in Louisville, and he was my county judge executive, and he's been a shit since 1978 when I first interviewed him, and he's always been a shit. And so I appreciate when people recognize him and call him for what he is, instead of I think too often we try to smooth things over and don't say what we really think. So I appreciate that. So what do you really think?
in answer of your two questions, first one I dismiss out of hand, that actors and celebrities, you know, that first of all, categorization is the laziest, stupidest fucking thing you can possibly do in this world. You categorize somebody because you first of all are setting him up to be an enemy and to be a scapegoat for your own, you know, inadequacies. It's very self-serving, but it's lazy.
Yeah.
You want to deal with me, motherfucker? Stop categorizing me and listen to what I'm saying. Listen to what I'm accusing you of, and listen to me about how everything you get taught in your church, wherever you fucking go to on Sunday, about the least of us and loving thy neighbor and all the golden rules and everything, you are so far from, you are so close to living in a living hell, you know, that you can't even tell right from wrong anymore. So, which leads me to the answer to the second part of your question, which is, if I'm as loud and crass and obscene in my reaction to you as I am, then how does that differentiate me from you? Well, what I'm doing is I'm yelling and screaming as loud as I can in defense of the better angels in this life, in defense of decency, in defense of true justice, in the defense of, you know, words that have been empty promises for a great part of our history, which is that all men are created equal, in defense of things that, as a sucker growing up in a lower middle class Jewish family in New York, I bought the fucking Kool-Aid. You know, if you're guilty of a crime, you go away.
Right.
If you fuck somebody over knowingly, you pay for that. And you pay for it to the degree that you fuck that person over. That may sound like Sharia law, but no, that's what our justice system is built on. And we have strayed so far away from what is true justice. It's a manipulation. This motherfucker Hawley, who's gonna, you know, pull this stunt. You know, I'd like to fucking run into him. I'll say this right on your air, bro. Let me run into that little motherfucker, and we'll talk about Stanford and Yale and how fucking smart he is.
Yeah.
We had an election, motherfucker. That's the cornerstone of our democracy, and you're making a mockery of it for what? Because you want to run? You want to get as much oxygen as your
right.
fucking asshole cunt friend Trump does? And you figured out that's the best way to do it? That's a manipulation. That makes people cynical. That makes people stop caring, which is what your goal is, isn't it? And yeah. shame on you. Because if we're not engaged and we're not intelligent and we're not looking at things, you know, in hopes of defending our better angels, defending the things that make life beautiful and worth living, like generosity and decency and self-sacrifice. If we're not doing those things and we're doing something completely the opposite of that, I have to call you out because you are insulting my intelligence. And you are using your good station in life in a way that is such an insult to the gift that God gave you of having a platform. And you are my enemy. And like all my enemies, I'm going to go after you. And even if it means, you know, if some shit happens, Brian, this is what I want to ask you.
Yeah.
If some shit happens on January 6th, mm-hmm. and we're actually dealing in a world where he starts winning the argument and overturning the election that 50 states have now certified. Do we go to the streets?
See, that's
do we take up arms? Because that's basically the whole big kahuna. That's democracy. That's the loss of democracy. And some of us feel like that's an important thing to preserve.
I do too.
A lot of us.
I don't think that he'll be able to turn, and look, whatever happens on January 6th, I firmly believe that this is, you nailed it right about Hawley. I mean, all that they're doing is trying to court voters and money for 2024. I don't think they understand the fire with which they're playing. I think that they...
Oh, they understand it.
I really don't think they... I think Mitch McConnell actually gets it. I think Mitch is the guy who, you know, he'll think of himself, he'll throw everybody under the bus to save his own ass, but he's got his life staked in the things as they exist in the status quo. I don't think that he's going to stomach them trying to turn it over. And of course, it's not going to go anywhere because the House won't let it. The House is run by Democrats. And come January 6th, there will be a delay because of this, and then it'll be certified. And then it will enable Trump to rant some more. It's those people. I'm less worried about Trump and Hawley and his and Lindsey Graham and all and Matt Gaetz and all these Satan's fluffers. I'm less worried about them than I am those who listen to his words and want to act upon his words, like the Proud Boys, who've already had one staged event in front of the White House. And they ended up stabbing each other, and it was you know, violence because they just want to fight. You talk about sons of anarchy; they're the real sons of anarchy. They're the ones that don't really give a flying fickle finger of fate of anything except fighting. And some of those are going to exist, but we always have violence in this country. I think there are too many people, even his supporters now, who go, "Well, I still have to get my kids to soccer practice when the lockdown ends. I still have to pay the rent." And I still want to take my kids out to dinner. And I think at the end of the day, once Trump is gone, it will subside. I think between now and the 20th, he's going to foment as much passion, because what Trump wants is money. And we had Michael Cohen on the show, and
he wants to stay out of jail.
Yeah, and that's it. What he's trying to do is he's got two things. And Cohen, who worked for him for years and knows him real well, said it boils down to this. He's done the math of the 74 million people that have voted for him. If he can get $20 a month from maybe 10 to 20 million of them, he can make a down payment on his debts, because he owes about $1 billion worldwide. And he can support himself in his legal fights, which are coming. Now, he says that, everyone's afraid that he'll quit the day before and have Mike Pence pardon him. There's an indication that and have Pence actually be the president for a day and then pardon Trump. There's some indication that Trump can pardon himself, and he's going to pardon everyone else that he likes. All of that's fine for federal crimes. The Southern District of New York is a little more discriminating. And as you said, Manhattan knows the bullshit. And there are going to, he can't go back into real estate. How's he going to make his money and pay his debts? That's what this is. This is the con. The
current he's already raised over $200 million off of the roofs.
Yeah. So off of that, but I think come January 20th, he will leave the White House. I think after the 6th, he may go back down to Mar-a-Lago and never come back. There are those who thought he wouldn't come back after Christmas, but because of the fact that he has this rally and now he wants to be around to try and influence up to the 6th, all of his moves are to make money. All of the guys who are on his train still are trying to curry favor with the populist movement that will exist after he leaves office. But I don't think anybody in the know, and I mean, even Mitch McConnell's people that I've spoken to, many of those in Congress go, look, he's gone on the 20th. And I said, well, I'll be at the White House on the 20th just to make sure if the marshals and the Secret Service have to yank him out and drag him out, I'll be there with my camera because I can't think of a better visual. You know, I hope
they got to drag him out, you know, like a little bitch, like the little bitch that he is.
Well, I talked to the Secret Service and they said, listen, after 12:01 p.m. on January 20th, he'll be a private citizen and he won't be the president. So he can't live in the White House. And we know how to deal with squatters. So I don't think he will be there after. But I don't think it'll come to that. I think at the end of the day,
I would like to have written a book about what the guys who guard him really think.
Oh, I could tell you stories, brother.
And if you're willing to, I'll just keep my mouth shut for the next hour, Brian, and just fucking listen. Because,
well, I'll tell you two good ones. There was one guy who's on his detail, and he got a lot of people sick because of some of the stuff that he's done. They, you know, there's a sign in the when you walk into the White House, the West Wing, that says, "From this point on, you have to wear masks." All the reporters do. None of the staff does. And they've all gotten sick. And Trump got numerous members of the Secret Service sick with COVID because of his antics. I talked to one of them and he was going, Trump keeps saying how supportive the Secret Service is of him. And he looks at his watch and he goes, till January 20th. So they don't play games. They're not in it with him. The other one is, of course, the story I told you about, you know, we know how to deal with squatters. And still a third one, when me and a reporter friend of mine, the day that they announced that Trump had lost the election, we had a drink, and I had a small bit of bourbon in my briefcase when I walked into the White House, and I told them why, and he said, save a drink for me. So I know they don't like him particularly. And there are stories they tell about him. I've heard him screaming and yelling in the White House on occasion at his chief of staff and some of his staff members. It's been a horrifying 4 years. I can't imagine being a member of his pulling guard duty for the Secret Service with him and knowing that at some point in time you may have to step in front of him and take a bullet. But they do it because that's what they do and not because they like the guy. And I value their service and find them to be very honorable, while many members of the White House staff are not. It's the alternative facts. It's all that stuff that bugs the shit out of me. And I know that's what angers you. I see that. I mean, do you ever feel like, Jesus Christ, how did we get here? Ever wonder, go, what the fuck?
Well, you know, there's a gazillion things that bother me, but nothing more so than how large the swath is of this nation that voted for him and that to this day are buying into the fact that he actually won the election. That can't be legislated away. That can't be fixed. That can't be. And I, not only do I not understand the thinking behind that, because it's, you know, it's beyond voting against your own self-interest. It's actual hastening the misery that you're so angry about, lengthening it, you know, making it something that will be, you know, generational. Won't just be you, it'll be your kids and your grandkids, as long as you sign up for the, you know, the grievance guy, the guy who is pushing your buttons. But he's pushing them in a way that, you know, is a manipulation and is so clearly not in anybody's interests other than the retention of power by him and his cronies. And the fact that there are as large a swath of citizens in the United States of America, that's the part of it that breaks my heart. That's the part of it that I don't know anyone who, I watch a lot of news. Everybody dances around that. Nobody wants to call that what it is. Nobody wants to put a name to it. Nobody wants to really begin to analyze. You know, you'll hear everybody once in a while going, we need to speak to that.
And they never, you speak to it.
You know, it's like that great line that Obama said in the White House, whatever that celebration is with the correspondence dinner.
Yeah,
you know,
White House correspondence.
People say, why don't you have a drink with Mitch McConnell? Why don't you have a drink with Mitch McConnell? You know, listen, you want to change those people's mind? Good luck. Go do it. I got my own kids. I got my own life. And I'm staking my claim on my side of the rock, you know, and yelling as loud as I can with my megaphone. Interestingly enough, getting back to the whole Hellboy thing,
yeah.
I came on Twitter in like 2012. I was still doing Sons of Anarchy, and I was one of the last cast members to come onto Twitter. I thought it was, you know, like, are you fucking kidding me? Twitter? It even sounds, you know, like,
yeah,
I won't characterize. You'll never catch me dead or alive on Twitter, right? But they worked on me, my cast members and my crew members and everything. And they said, Pearl, you know, this is fun, man. This is a lot of fun. And so I came on. And of course, because I was on a hit show at the time, I went from 0 to 30,000 followers immediately. Mm-hmm. But they were all from red states. I was playing the president of a racist, you know, anarchist, unlawful, ass-kicking, you know, porn-promoting, gun-toting group of people, man. I mean, I was the poster boy.
You'd have fit in the White House.
And I was the poster. And so, now I'm on Twitter and I got 30,000 and growing, you know, red state people who little by little are going, wait a minute, what did he just say? Did he just give a hickey to some fucking Democrat? And it took a long time for people to actually even understand or be willing to acknowledge that I'm not Clay Morrow. I'm not the biker guy who's a racist and who, you know, like, who only hangs out with white people and who runs guns and, you know, who will kill any federal agent that comes within a mile of his house or his family. I'm not that guy. I'm Ron Perlman, this lower middle class Jew married to a black woman from Jamaica with two kids with her and forever Democrat, complete snowflake, bleeding heart, fucking. And when, you know, there was a kind of a delayed reaction, but eventually people started to, like, you motherfucker.
Right.
And they were really angry with me for a while. And then the job became switching, making the switch complete, which is, you know, originally when I started realizing I was disappointing people and pissing people off, I backed off my, you know, liberal, you know, but eventually I just started throwing little droplets of salt and pepper into the soup. To the fact that, to the point where now it became 25% of what I was putting out.
Right.
Soon it became 50%. And it took about 3 years for me to convert my following. There's still people on there that are pissed off at me because I'm supposed to be, you know, this badass. You know, once again, it's the categorization thing. Right. And it's like, but it was a real heavy lift transforming my following. And I hate to use that word because it sounds so fucking, you know, bullshitty, celebrity bullshit. But, you know, you have one, and it took a long time to completely turn them into the followers of the guy who's in other things other than Sons of Anarchy and stands for other things other than, you know, his acting career and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So I understand the disconnect very like on a first name basis.
But here's my question to you. You've been on both sides of it. And this is the last thought we'll have. We'll take a quick break before we come back and have a little bit of fun. But the question I have for you is,
we're not having fun now.
No, have a little. I am. I hope you are.
I'm having a lot of fun. Okay. My ulcer is shrinking as I rant and rave here.
Oh, I had a date like that once. I'm telling you, you know.
tell you.
Puff room. Before we go to break, you've seen both sides. And you talked about how you stake your claim and they've staked. And is there, Biden is coming into office promising unity. Do you see any path to unity?
I do.
How?
Unequivocally, I do. Because the reason why we didn't notice how large the population of discontent was and how eager people were to sign on to a cult of personality like Donald Trump and everything that he stood for and the amount of support that he got even from the mainstream is because unfortunately we're dealing in a world that only reacts to what they have right in front of their nose and only reacts to things that affect them directly. And when you have a certain how is it possible that Barack Obama left office with a north of 70% approval rating, which are incredible numbers by any stretch of the imagination. And yet the next president is Donald fucking Trump. How is that possible? It's possible because we have this unfortunate tendency to only deal with what's in front of us. And we will react to whatever we think is going to make our pain go away. I feel like that is going to apply to the Biden administration as well, because they're going to start seeing Biden rowing in a direction where the numbers are going to start coming down and he's going to mobilize the federal government as it should have been mobilized back in February. And people will have PPE and people will have a PPP or whatever it's fucking, whatever they're voting on in Congress to give people unemployment and some sort of break on their rent and some sort of break on having money in their pocket to pay their bills. While we get our arms around what the asshole called, you know, being a wartime president, because we are at war, but he never did anything close to being a wartime president, because we could have fucking, you know, the 350,000 dead people in America, that would probably be around 75,000 if the United States had done what the United States does when it's at its best, which is create a federal response, not throwing anything to the states, throwing tremendous amount of resources to everybody. So everybody's happy and everybody's really happy to like get behind this effort. But the reason why we didn't realize that any of that was possible is because that's not what we were seeing. When we do see that, we will react in kind. And that's what I'm saying. And that's kind of like, it makes me happy, but it makes me sad that we have to see it right in front of our own noses to understand, yes, the better path is when this country is like really, really, really all doing everything together, like we did in World War II, you know, like we've done on so many other occasions. We're capable of doing it. It's just that the leadership is tearing us asunder and diabolically, you know, making us hate one another for their own, you know,
for their own
hold on power.
Yeah, for their end of their pocketbook. And with that wonderful thought, we'll take a break and we'll be right back. Well, time to pay the bills, folks. And this one I don't mind doing. I've actually used this. If this 2020 holiday season feels like it's been a long time, come and make it worth the wait with Omaha Steaks. Omaha Steaks makes the perfect gift for family and friends or to treat yourself. All shipped directly to your door. They offer everything you need to bring families together for a delicious holiday feast. Okay, or maybe not, maybe just a delicious festival. Their deluxe grillers assortment package includes a variety of entrees, sides, and desserts. Right now, you can get this mouth-watering package. I've never actually seen a mouth water. Oh, well, anyway, plus 4 free burgers and a free digital meat thermometer. And we all need a good meat thermometer. An exclusive price only available to our listeners. So go to omahasteaks.com and enter the code QUESTION into the search bar. Get a jump on gift shopping with Omaha Steaks. You know, Omaha Steaks isn't just a steak. It's actually a lot of them. It's a fantastic gift and a safe way to share the joy of the season with Omaha Steaks, guaranteed quality and safety with every order. Order the Deluxe Grillers Assortment Package today, and you'll receive 4 free Omaha Steak Burgers and a free digital meat thermometer. That's just a great straight line I won't use. When you go to omahasteaks.com and type question in the search bar, that's omahasteaks.com and type question. And if you need to spell it, it's QUESTION in the search bar, and you'll shop for the best gourmet gifts of the season. I like a good raw steak, so enjoy it. It is a lot of fun. Hi, it's Just Ask a Question. I am your host, Brian Kierman. With us still is Ron Perlman. Ron, I want to ask you this. I've often said, at having been in the White House briefing room on many occasions with Donald Trump, he reminds me of a failed stand-up comic. Sometimes it's almost painful to watch him try and crack a joke, and he doesn't seem to understand his audience. Have you ever walked now? And I ask you that knowing full well, as we talked before the show, that you had one time tried to be a stand-up comic.
Well, the impulse to be a stand-up comic grows directly out of the need to be effective. To affect a response from people. The minute you affect a response from people, you're validated. You know, you are given attention and therefore given validation, and therefore you feel a certain sort of importance, and you know that you have some sort of control over your popularity, what people think about you, et cetera, those are very kind of aphrodisiacal qualities to have. So that's the impulse behind being a stand-up comic. Unfortunately, you know, you have to be funny, and you have to be, you know, the best comics are brilliant. I mean, they're actual brilliant, real intellectual people, very well-read, very, very deep thinkers, critical thinkers. And that's how they're able to access the duality and the absurdity and the satire that comes with the human condition. And so Trump has none of those. What he does have is the first thing, which is like, I need to affect myself on people. I need to exact a response from you, and I'll do it any way I can. That's not stand-up comedy. That's something that you'd have to ask Freud about. It's above my pay grade.
Why did you stop being a comic?
It was hard, man. I didn't do it very long. I did it for about 5 minutes. And I think I was in high school at the time. I had a partner named Spencer Schwartz, and I was Ronald Perlman. So it wasn't cool to be Jews at the time. So we became Stewart and Perry. And we basically stole other comics' material.
Such as?
And my favorite people to steal from were, you know, these two people don't go together, but they're both very, very funny. And when you put them together, you've created a kind of a fog around, wait a minute, he doesn't sound like either of those two guys, and yet he's completely quoted Henny Youngman and George Carlin.
Oh my God.
So all my material was stolen directly from Henny Youngman and George Carlin. And those two people don't go together on any level except for the fact that they're both fall down funny.
Yeah.
And we were getting, you know, we were getting asked to perform. We did it at a party, and then everybody said, hey, why don't you do it at the school dance? And then, hey, there's a club that is opening in the Bronx. And we started to like get these little gigs, you know, doing Henny Youngman and George Carlin's material. And we performed in a discotheque in like near Arthur Avenue in the Bronx. You know that neighborhood?
Yeah, I know it. Well, my kids lived there for a while. Right.
So very tough neighborhood. I'll tell you how tough that neighborhood was. Somebody says, how far is the subway from here? And I said, I don't know, nobody ever made it.
That's Rodney. That's I'm telling you, it was a tough neighborhood, you know. After they sack the quarterback, they go after his mother, you know. Every time somebody was on 10 fingers.
Somebody in high school said, what's for lunch today? He says, broken leg of lamb. So we got heckled this one night in this discotheque on Arthur Avenue in the Bronx. And in the back row were all of the guys who were the dates of the chicks who were sitting in the front row. The chicks loved us. They were laughing and they were having the best all time. And somebody yelled out something and I thought we were being heckled, and I heckled back. And en masse, the whole back row of guys got up and started for the stage. Holy and Spencer God. And I got out the back door. This was long before Uber. We had like catch a cab and got the fuck out of Arthur Avenue and showbiz all in one.
That was it, huh? Who's your favorite actor you've ever worked with?
My favorite actor that I've ever worked with. I've worked with Brando.
I know.
And he's the greatest actor who ever lived. Wasn't my favorite experience because it wasn't, we weren't together long enough to create a real rapport the actors that I've worked with, who I worked with over a long period of time and who I watched on the daily pull shit out of their ass that I went, how the fuck did you just do that? Like, my favorite actor on Sons was Kim Coates, who played Tig.
Yeah.
My favorite actor on Hand of God was Garrett Dillahunt, who played this guy who was in and out of prison, and I was a judge, and I sort of took him in and had him be my deus ex machina to do evil deeds. Those two guys were phenomenal, kind of unsung, brilliant actors, although they're both always working, so they're sung and unsung, but they're not household names. I'm in the middle of doing a movie right now with Meryl Streep. I did one scene with her a couple of weeks ago. Also on that stage was Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, and Jonah Hill, and Rob Morgan. So I was on a stage with some of the greatest performers who ever lived. But like I said, I wasn't there long enough to establish a rapport or a friendship or, hey, you're my favorite, I can't wait to get back to work with you again, because there was no real history that we created together.
The name of the movie, and when's it come out?
It's called Don't Look Up. It's Adam McKay, the same guy who brought you all of the Talladega Nights and, you know, those great, yeah, Will Ferrell movies, the Anchorman movies. And
I actually did an Anchorman like him, but that's another story. But
yeah, I'll bet you did.
Yeah,
he did The Big Short, and he's done some real interesting work. And so this is his modern day version of a kind of a Dr. Strangelove, where the earth is about to be ended.
Well, the Trump administration. You also worked with Sean Connery. How was that?
Phenomenal.
I miss him as an actor, just by the way he spoke.
You would have loved him, man. I mean, you know, you and I don't know each other really on a personal level, although we admire each other a lot for our political
and your
musings, But I have a funny feeling, you know, you're the kind of guy who would spot the guy's guy and the guy you want to go have a beer with.
Yeah.
And say, hey, motherfucker, let's go have a beer. That was Sean. I mean, Sean came, his father was a coal miner. He was the first one to remind you of that when you met him. I'm not a movie star. You know, I'm very blue collar. You know, I'm fuck all that shit, you know. And he wanted you to know that he was a working class hero. Which is great because, you know, I'm from a lower, like real lower middle class family with no money at all. And so he doesn't disappoint you. You know, you say to yourself, Jesus, I hope this guy who I've seen in 100 movies now and who I, you know, couldn't put into words my admiration for him as a performer, I hope he doesn't disappoint me as a human. And the great thing about Sean is that he didn't. He was... incredibly encouraging to me in my performance, incredibly generous with regard to pulling out of me how to be myself and how to be even better than I was. He wanted me to shine. And then he realized pretty early on that I was a sucker for the great old stories about the old Hollywood, and he had worked with Hitchcock and John Huston and stuff. And so he regaled me with all these fantastic stories of old lore or old Hollywood that you're only going to hear from a guy like Sean Connery.
Yeah.
And it was amazing experience. And I miss him terribly.
My favorite line from him still has to be from Goldfinger. My name is Pussy Galore. I must be dreaming. I can't believe they even got that past the Hollywood censor in 64.
I know, because it was Sean saying it. They went, yeah, fuck it.
Yeah, that's right. Ah, hell, it's Sean Connery. Let it fly. Right. What's your favorite project that you've worked on? Your own personal favorite, or your own favorite performance? If it's different, I don't know.
Well, I've been very lucky, and I, you know, every actor says this. You know, I've been I'm so fortunate. I'm so blessed, but I really have been, because they should have counted me out like 30 years ago, and yet I keep getting new air pumped into the lungs of whatever it is that's keeping me going. And I keep getting these unbelievable characters to play. The Beast on Beauty and the Beast, Hellboy, the Hunchback in Name of the Rose, you know, the TV characters, you know, starting with Sons, well, not with starting with Beauty and the Beast, but Sons of Anarchy, and then the Judge Purnell Harris in this Hand of God show, all phenomenal characters. But about 8 years ago, I kind of fulfilled the lifelong dream of starting my own production company.
Huh?
And I put together a film fund and produced about 9 movies. And one of them was called Asher, A-S-H-E-R, which is about an Israeli aging hitman living in New York City who's killing people you don't even know why or who.
Sounds like my uncle.
Yeah. No, but the beautiful thing about the movie is that it's completely unexplained. It's purely a character study of a guy who has a skill set and who uses it and who has his own way of squaring that up with the gods. It was a little movie. Nobody saw it, but I think it's my best performance, and I certainly feel as though we overcame every obstacle you can overcome. The movie got shut down 2 or 3 times because we ran out of money.
Quest for Fire?
No. You know, that's another good one. But if you ask me, my favorite is Asher. And I wish more people had seen it, but I don't even think you can find it if you wanted to.
The one I thought there was a level that I liked was, and I know it was a big movie, but there were a couple of takes on looks where there was there were layers to the performance that I really liked, and that was Alien Resurrection. I thought that was, I don't know, it was an action movie, but there are a couple of scenes where the pathos and the humanity of your character came through, that it was more than bravado, which kind of helped sell the movie a little bit. That was my own personal toss.
Thank you.
For what it's
worth. I hated it.
Did Did you?
I'm kidding. I'm joking. I kid. You see, I'm trying to resurrect that. I'm trying to resurrect that stand-up comedy thing while sitting down.
I'm telling you.
My doctor told me to jog 5 miles a day. A week later, I called him. I said, "Doc, I'm 70 miles from my house."
Yeah. Well, my favorite Rodney is, I'm telling you, it was tough. You know, my proctologist used to be a photographer. He said, "Bend over and say cheese."
That's pretty good. You know, if this journalist thing doesn't work out for you.
Yeah, after 40 years of doing it, I don't know, it may not work out. I love it when people go, you have no career ahead of you. I'm going, well, okay. After 40 years, maybe not.
I think that was it was either a Sam Goldwyn or one of the Warner Brothers said that they were trying to figure out who to cast in the lead for this movie. And somebody mentioned a certain name and Goldwyn said, "Oh, him, he's got some career behind him."
Ooh, it is stand-up sitting down. Yeah. You do a great Sean Connery, by the way. Do you do other impressions or is that just the one?
I mean, you know, the way I do Sean is the way, I mean, I used to play with stuff, you know, in my stand-up days. Part of where I was heading was, you know, doing some, I don't really do impressions as much as I do impressions of people who are doing the impressions first. So if Frank Gorshin did an impression of Kirk Douglas, I'm doing Frank Gorshin. You know yeah. What I mean? It's like, I can't do the impersonation until somebody does it first. And somebody already figures out what the caricature of it all is.
Right.
And does the heavy lifting for me because I'm basically a pretty lazy guy, Brian.
Yeah, I like, if you're doing stand up sitting down, that tells me everything I need to know.
I'm gonna perfect the lying down version of stand up.
So. Well, that's the old Roman saying: never do anything standing up that you can do sitting down. Never do anything sitting down that you can do lying down.
That's my religion right there. You just encapsulated everything I believe. Everything.
Well, there you go. We'll take another short break, and we'll be right back. All Steaks makes the perfect gift for family and friends or to treat yourself, all shipped directly to your door. They offer everything you need to bring families together for a delicious holiday feast.
Okay.
When you go to omahasteaks.com and type question in the search bar, that's omahasteaks.com and type question. And if you need to spell it, it's Q-U-E-S-T-I-O-N in the search bar. And you'll shop for the best gourmet gifts of the season. I like a good raw steak, so enjoy it. It is a lot of fun.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast, for all the updates your little heart could desire. That's JATQ Podcast. Again, that's at JATQ Podcast. All right.
Hi, and we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karam, and with us still is Ron Perlman. And Ron, a couple of final thoughts. Where would you like to see, I mean, you've had a lot of fun in your career, and is there any project you haven't done that you'd like to do? Is the first question I have for you. Is there something you close to your heart you'd like to do?
Literally, the projects that I've gotten to work with on, especially lately, and the quality of artists that I've gotten to kind of rub shoulders with while doing it have gone so far beyond anything I could ever have dreamed. And I qualify this by saying I'm a really big dreamer. So to make that statement is, which leads me to the fact that, yeah, I used to worry about, I want to do this and I don't anymore, because it the stuff that's just falling my way are beyond my anything I could possibly imagine or wish for. So you're looking at one of the happier guys you've ever come across. I mean, very fulfilled. I'm 70 years old. You know, I technically might have retired 5 years ago. So I also look upon this as like everything I do is gravy. And, you know, if I could put in some legacy stuff, you know, things that actually, well, I'll tell you, this one thing that I'm actively trying to get together is The Last Days of Hemingway. We have a screenplay, we have a budget, we have a filmmaker, and I want to shoot at least 90% of it in Cuba, which is which is where he spent some of those last days. 55% of the movie takes place in the finca, which was his estate down there just outside of Havana, which I visited and which we have access to. So that's something. I never visited his place in Key West. I will, though, when the pandemic is over.
Yeah.
But the one in Cuba is, and the time he spent in Cuba and his attitude toward his relationship with Cuba was not only special, but precipitated his death in a lot of ways. And it's a story that leading up to his suicide that nobody has really kind of ever grappled with. So I'm very proud of what we've created thus far, and I just got to find the money to do the movie. And, you know, hopefully the Biden administration will make things a lot easier than traveling back and forth.
Maybe we'll all get, you know, vaccinated at some point in time. Under the current regime, it would take, what they said, 10 years with its warp speed rollout that really pulls a, you know, like a turtle crawl. For the country, and I like I said when we started this conversation, the thing that really has drawn me to your tweets is you put into words what I think a lot of people think, but some people are too timid to say. So as bluntly as you want, tell me what your hopes are and what is your, I guess, what your hopes are for the incoming administration and what your fears are because of the outgoing administration. And can we somehow bring those two together?
My fears are that, I'll start with my fears, because I always, you know, now that it's the time of COVID, it's finally cool to be negative. I just want to say,
I'm telling you,
Rodney would have been proud of that.
Yeah, that's a tough room, you know.
Right to the moon. What I worry about is how close we came to, and why I wanted to talk more about that January 6th date, and will there ever be a moment where it is civil war, where we do take to the streets to defend our democracy, you know, where people are willing to die for the cause of you know, we've seen it.
Yeah, we
you
have. Know,
I agree with everything you said. It's not going to happen, but we've now gotten a glimpse of the fact that if certain people had their way, it could happen. Like that.
Yeah.
And it was prior to this moment in time, prior to this horrible, nightmarish, you know, scenario we've lived through called the Trump years. It was unimaginable. It was something that was not fathomable. It was something that was outside of the realm of even your imagination, much less possibility. And now it's incredibly possible.
Yeah, we've stepped into the abyss.
And we've been forced to grapple with things that we heretofore took for granted about our freedom and about democracy and about, you know, the sanctity of voting. And, you know, and I have an amazing hope that in a very short order, that order will be restored in the world in terms of our allies are going to understand that this was an aberration. There was nothing to get really mad at us about, because this was not American policy. This was one guy's, you know, ego trip. And our enemies are going to understand, okay, we better go back into the shadows, because this motherfucker is going to smack us down. I know he will. And the environment is going to get addressed, and the pandemic is going to get addressed. I feel as though on day one, the Biden administration will throw all of what is great about the federal government and its resources at everything that has been neglected for the 4 years. So I don't worry that there's been irreparable damage, although the earth really, really couldn't afford 4 years of neglect. I mean, we are on a really serious, you know, this climate change thing. We couldn't afford the 4 years where he pissed on everything the way he did. That's one thing that I do worry about, because that'll affect my ability to be a grandfather. Because I'm already having conversations with my kids who are about thinking about having kids. hey, maybe you want to rethink this, because in 30 or 40 years, you could be dealing with tsunamis and hurricanes, irreparable damage, you know.
You sound a lot, you know, who said the same thing on this show, Sam Donaldson. He said, 4 years of Donald Trump, we can recover from. But if we had had him for another 4 years, he didn't think that we would be able to recover from it. And he pointed to the same thing that you did. Climate change is probably one of the biggest things that Donald Trump has screwed us on. And yeah, I have to agree with that. But going forward, to finish your thought.
But going forward, I have great faith. I have great faith in our ability to heal. I have great faith in our ability to change course. And I have great faith in those of us who are the custodians of the better angels. You know, and I feel as though if the last 4 years have taught us everything, is like, you better stay vigilant. You know, being the defender of good is not something that you take a break from. It's not something you do 5 days a week and then take the weekend off. It's 24/7, baby. And yeah. Here's my dog. Say hello.
Hey, what's your dog's name?
Harrington.
Harrington. What kind of dog is he and how old?
He's, we're not exactly sure exactly how old he is. We just rescued him from Korea.
Wow. Yeah. We have a couple of rescue dogs and a couple of rescue cats. I could do without the cats. My wife loves them, but the rescue dogs are great.
Well, yeah, my fiance is, she only rescues dogs, and she keeps checking the shelters. And because of COVID, all of the shelters are empty. Everybody got dogs. So yeah. There was nobody to rescue. And then she found this site in Korea, you know, where they save dogs from, you know, the meat market. You know, the nightmare of and then they try to place them in homes, you know, mostly in the United States. And so we got this dog Harrington about 8 weeks ago, and we know he's at least 8 weeks old. But he's a black lab, my first ever black lab.
Those are great dogs.
So loving, so cute, so hysterical. He's got a little stand-up comedy in him.
Most black labs do. Ours was that way. We called him.
He's really, really funny.
But I had a friend of mine. He's in my band. He's a local judge. He rescued, him and his wife rescued a dog. I think it was from Singapore or from Thailand. A crippled dog, had no back legs, and they were going to put the dog to death. And she saw it, and she had the dog brought over to the United States. Friendly dog. It's got its own wheelchair that they built for it. He tools around like he's, you know, in the middle of a gig.
They don't wallow in what they've lost, these dogs. I mean, we have another friend who just rescued a dog from China who was three-legged. And, you know, this dog will kill you with kindness and lick your face off. And it's so positive and just runs and romps and plays as if nothing is askew at all. So they're amazing. They're amazingly resilient.
There's a Rodney joke in that one. The other leg ended up in chop suey.
You didn't hear that.
I did. Listen, Ron, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, man. I'd love to have you back.
Well, I really appreciate you're asking me. And, you know, I'm such a fan of where you're willing to put yourself in all that melee that is, man, you've seen it all. Sarah Sanders and Kelly McEnany. I mean, you know, Jesus Christ, you talk about an assault on logic and sanity.
Every day.
But you put yourself, you're one of those guys that, you know, put yourself right in the eye of the hurricane. And I really admire that. And we need more guys like you who are willing to say, no, I'm looking at something black. It's not white. I'm sorry. There are certain things as empirical facts that cannot be disputed.
Well, you and I have similar upbringing, and it was, you know, my dad, my mom, who kind of, it's like, look, and my dad was like, the only way to react to a bully is to thump him in the nose, stand up to a bully. And that's what, he's a con artist bully. And the people that he hires are after their own power and glory, and they're much the same. There's not a whole lot of there are not many intellectual giants in the Trump administration. I'll tell you that. And I don't understand why people put their head down and go, well, we just go on business as usual. This has not been business as usual. It hasn't been for 4 years, not from day one, not from the day. If you didn't know where this administration was going on the very first day when Sean Spicer came in and said, we had the largest inaugural crowds in history, and clearly the photographs didn't show it, and people nodded. That wouldn't last in my neighborhood. You can only bullshit people so much in my neighborhood, and you better be able to, you know, at the end of the day, you better be able to put up or shut up. They never put up and they never shut up. That's where it's been for 4 years. So I appreciate that. But
anyway, yeah, God bless you, Brian, and the work you do, man. And
God bless you, too, man. Appreciate it.
I don't understand how all those insiders that you referred to could have allowed us to get so close to the brink of throwing this republic completely into the trash bin. and nobody really, like, I don't understand how the intelligence community, after being dissed by him the way they were and fired and have careers like Pete Strzok and Jim Comey and all those guys destroyed, have not figured out a way to take him out like Chinese food, man.
Well, after January 20th, he'll be in the refuse heap. I agree with you on that. I don't know why they didn't take, I think they had an excellent opportunity when he was impeached. I stood there in the East Room when he came out with his victory lap. And it was, to me, it was like, the show Freaks, One of Us, One of Us. I sat there and watched just QAnon supporters, narcissists, sexists, racists, in the White House, in a place I hold dear, that I always held reverent from the first day I walked in there in 1986, and they just trashed it. And everything that this country stands for, they trashed. And they let them. They were glorious in their victory over the republic. They were glorious in their victory over democracy. They were they glorified themselves in their victory over common sense, facts, and decency. And I'll never forget
them. It's the religion of obstruction of justice.
Yeah.
It's actually a religion to them.
Yeah, it's a stain on the fabric of America, and it's going to take a long time to erase it. I think it started with Nixon, Reagan,
Well, it'll pop its head up again, you know, that's for sure. But I think what we're aware now of, if we take our eye off the ball, and how large a segment of the population they're able to sway dramatically to the point of, you know, destroying the whole ball game.
Well, I always have faith that common sense, maybe that's the Gandhi. I'm paraphrasing from Gandhi, that, you know, the evil may persist for a while and you may think that it's successful, but in the end, all despots fall. And that's true. And that's because you get tired of it. But we'll see. I have faith that, at least for the next generation, that people are awake. And the younger, the kids that are my kids' age and younger that are coming up, I hope they've learned from it. Our generation should have. And I feel like in some regards, we dropped the ball a bit. But
yeah,
because Donald Trump is, like you said, I'm the tail end of that baby boomer generation. He's the lead, and he should have. How does a guy who grew up with Woodstock, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, 1968, the Tet Offensive, how do you turn a blind eye to the Summer of Love, to, all we are saying is give peace? How do you turn a blind eye to all that we've learned over those years and embrace what he has and his followers have embraced? And I think that's a question that's going to fill volumes for the next 20 years in history books. But
what was the name of McCarthy's? His heroes were Jeffrey Epstein and Roy Cohn, while you were listening to Beatles songs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was getting high and getting laid, and they were trying to screw me out of money.
That's
life in the fast lane. Listen, man, thanks again. Last question I gotta ask. Beatles or Stones?
Oh, I'm a Beatles guy. And going away, I mean, the songbook of the Beatles is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
So deep and so clever and so brilliant and so musically diverse and harmonically sophisticated. And yeah, it's they are in a class by themselves.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, me too. I'm always Beatles first.
I was actually the other movie that I'll plug while you're not shutting me up is right before I did Don't Look Up, I did a remake of a movie called Nightmare Alley that my friend Guillermo del Toro directed and starred Bradley Cooper. And Bradley walked onto the set one day and said, "What's the best album ever?" And a lot of people, you know, "Well, you know," and he said, "Sergeant Pepper's." And it was immediate. It was like everybody just went, "Oh, well, you can't argue with that." That is the greatest album ever recorded because it changed everything.
It did. And when I talk to musicians, they always, especially some of the musicians who were around back then, they go, "We woke up when that album came out." But I mean, I like all of the Beatles albums. I mean,
oh yeah, me too. But yeah. that was a sea change. I mean, that was like, yeah. They are on a completely different wavelength right now.
Yeah, that was the good acid.
the good Kool-Aid.
Yeah, that was the good Kool-Aid. What's your favorite Beatles? Do you have a Beatles song that that isn't popular, that people don't know, that you favor, that you might say that? Because all of them are well known, everything they released. But is there something more obscure that you like that maybe people don't listen to as much?
I mean, I'm subject to mood swings, and so, you know, there are certain days where "Because" is like, I've never heard anything quite as beautiful as that. You know, "Because the world is..."
Yeah.
And then there's "While My Guitar Gently Weeps." There's certain days where that becomes my most, but I'll just listen to Eleanor Rigby. I'll listen to "Yesterday."
I'll give you two that I like that you don't hear that much. And it's off of, if you've got, it's an EP in England, in the United States, it's an album, and that's Yellow Submarine. On the first side, it's "All Too Much" by George Harrison, which is a great song. And then my second one off of that is "Hey Bulldog," that I think is...
I'm going to go play that album as soon as we hang up.
Yeah, the great rocker, and with electronic feedback and everything. Just two fun songs. Anyway, we could do this all day, Ron. I appreciate you being on the show.
Great way to end a year and start a new one, my brother.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you. I hope you have a great one. It can't be worse than 2020. We lost Marianne too. That's another thing. I can't believe it. Anyway.
All right, man.
Happy New Year to you, and thanks for being with us.
I'll see you in 2021, baby.
Yeah, the name of the show is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Kerman. Thanks for being with us.